From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, how the environment surrounding both fitness trackers and workplace wellness incentives could change in the near future.
Then we'll meet a Milwaukee ambassador to Korean culture.
Many people knew that I was from Korea, possibly, but they would start out with the question, are you Chinese or are you from China? And I thought, you know what? I need to educate people about who I am through my country and my culture.
Why local blogger Cree Miles wanted to celebrate female artists for Black History Month.
I'm like, oh yeah, look, a black woman. Like, you're so used to not seeing them that when you see them, you like do a double take, even as one. Like, I'm a black woman and I'm still surprised when I see a black woman in art, which is crazy.
And Bubbler Talk discovers the artist behind the iconic Koss billboards on I-43. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Mobile wellness devices like the Fitbit, the Apple or Garmin watch are ubiquitous these days. Many of us wear them with the goal of holding ourselves accountable for our physical fitness.
They are also becoming a tool that employers are using with a separate but related goal, having healthy employees and controlling healthcare costs.
But the devices themselves are evolving and may soon make more promises than just counting your steps or keeping track of your heart rate.
And that means they could face a different kind of regulation than what governs them today. It is a topic contributor Barbara Zabawa wrote about not long ago for the American Bar Association. Zabawa is the owner of the Center for Health and Wellness Law and a clinical assistant professor in the College of Health Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. Welcome back to the show. Great to see you.
So glad to be here, Mitch.
A lot of people have fitness trackers and other mobile health devices. I have a relatively basic one on my wrist. It counts my steps. It's supposed to measure my sleep, my activity level, the calories I burned. Other people have them integrated into a smartwatch. I think you may have one of those right now.
I do.
What is happening in this industry that makes it about more than people getting a fitness tracker for Christmas and keeping track of their activity?
Yes, well, I mean, there's been a lot of talk with some wellness devices, that's what I call the Apple Watch and Fitbits and things like that, moving into more of a clinical use. So treating chronic diseases or conditions or trying to help prevent those conditions. And when wellness devices move in that direction, they just have to be more aware of the fact that they may be subject to FDA regulation, because FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, regulates medical devices. And medical devices are loosely defined as those devices that are aiming to treat or prevent disease. And so when you move away from just being a wellness device and a lifestyle kind of device, and into more of a treatment realm, then you could be subject to FDA regulation. And so that's just something that not the consumer needs to worry so much about. It's more for the manufacturer and the distributor of those devices that they'll need to be concerned about FDA regulation.
When it comes to regulation, does it make a difference whether these are consumer-driven or employer-driven reasons for wearing these devices? I mean, let's say, you know, I have a Fitbit and, you know, I'm basically using it to keep track of my steps. Does it make a difference if, you know, my doctor is asking me to wear it or my employer demands that I wear it as part of a wellness program?
Not really. What determines whether the FDA will get involved in a device is the intended use, and the intended use has to be related to treatment of disease or other illnesses, or trying to prevent diseases. And a lot of these devices do in effect do that, but the intended use really is for keeping track of your steps, as you mentioned, or smartwatches, checking your email, and there's a lot of other functionalities that take place. I mean, they also do check your heart rate, but I don't think that's the intended use of the device. It's to to keep track of, you know, if you're going to have a heart attack. So,
well, and I gather companies like Fitbit are increasingly seeing themselves as less about individual consumers and more as players in the larger healthcare field.
Yes. Well, I think they have some desire to move into that field. It's a field full of a lot of money. And it's, you know, obviously almost 18% of our gross domestic product nationally. So it's quite a huge industry, and there are a lot of things that industry can do to improve outcomes, improve the health of the population. And so it makes sense that they may be looking to, you know, move into the clinical world, but that's when the FDA comes into play, and that's just something that they need to be cognizant of, and that's what I wrote in a recent article for the American Bar Association.
Well, right, and so presumably the FDA has these regulations in place for the benefit of all of us. Beyond knowing that they're regulations, what are the kinds of things when it comes to medical devices that the FDA involves itself in?
So it's regulating, you know, it wants those devices to be registered, first of all. And ultimately, what it cares about is safety, consumer safety. So when you get into more of the clinical realm, the devices are going to, you know, maybe be more invasive, or you're going to be making claims about, you know, being able to cure or prevent. And the FDA is going to step in and make sure that what you say it will do that as safely and won't harm consumers. I mean, because that's what they care about. They don't want any device or drug, because they regulate drugs too, out in the marketplace that will hurt the consumer or give them a false belief in something.
Right. This is like the difference when we see in TV commercials between, you know, what's a medicine and what's a nutritional supplement. And, you know, obviously the disclaimer on it that this product is not intended to treat, diagnose, or cure any disease.
Yes, right. It's a great observation.
And so presumably the same could be said for these wellness devices, especially as they develop down the road and the FDA gets more involved.
Right. I mean, so the FDA just came out actually last month with a revised guidance about wellness devices and mobile apps. I mean, there are a lot of apps out there that you can use for nutrition, for exercise, and things like that. And the FDA said that for wellness-type devices, they are not going to either consider them medical devices at all, which means they don't fall within its regulatory authority, or if they are, they could be considered medical devices, they aren't going to enforce their regulations against those devices. And they have a list that they came up with of things or similar things that they would not enforce. They would use their enforcement discretion, or that they would not consider medical devices at all. And that my article kind of goes into that as well.
You write that there are some recent examples of how companies who saw themselves in one part of the industry didn't play by the regulatory rules as they expanded into other parts of the healthcare world, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's easy to get used to a more loose, regulated industry, and then when you move into a more regulated industry, which is what healthcare is, to kind of get lost or forget or not realize that you've kind of stepped into that realm.
You also write that wellness program incentives, this is a good transition because I know at one point in the history of the wellness program that we have here, it resulted in getting a fitness tracker. You write that wellness program incentives by employers could become a thing of the past.
Yeah, well, there's certainly a lot of buzz about that possibility. And what prompted that buzz was a recent court decision by the District of Columbia District Court in the AARP v. EEOC case. So the AARP sued the EEOC back in 2016 about the EEOC's rules under the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act.
A lot of letters here.
Yes. And the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. The EEOC came up with some rules under those two laws that said employers can impose incentives, financial incentives, to encourage employees to give up their personal health information, usually through a health risk assessment or a biometric screen. So if you work for a company that asks you to fill out a survey about your health or asks you to give blood so they can figure out your glucose or cholesterol levels, they may give you some monetary reward for doing that. And the EEOC said in its rules that they could do that. The AARP disagreed and said, you know, a lot of employees, especially those with lower incomes, may not be able to afford that incentive. And you're therefore compelling them, forcing them to give up their personal health information. And we think that's against the law, the ADA in particular. So they sued and they won. And the court in December of 2017, just a month ago, basically said that the EEOC had to rewrite those rules. And one of my predictions is that the EEOC is going to have a hard time finding an incentive amount that all employees, regardless of their income, would still be a voluntary wellness program.
So this is the idea, like an employer offers a certain amount of money to go through a biometric screening or mm-hmm. what have you, and the only people who feel comfortable saying, no, I don't need that, are the ones who are financially well off to begin with.
Yeah, right. Right. So the lower income employees may feel like they can't. That's money. That's significant amount of money that they would lose, or they might have to pay a significant amount more for their health insurance. So they feel like they have no choice but to take the health risk assessment or go through the biometric screen. And the ADA states that, you know, if employers are going to collect that information, it has to be voluntary. And so if you start putting money into this HRA, as they call it, or biometric screen, then it may no longer feel voluntary for a lot of employees. So the EEOC has to go back to the drawing board and figure out, well, what amount of money would all employees feel that it was a voluntary activity? And I think they're going to have a hard time coming up with a number. And they have to do it later this year. And the current rules are no longer going to be in existence as of January next year. So employers, many may feel like they don't want to bother with the incentives. I also think that many employers will still pursue incentives and use other legal avenues to do that. And we can get into that some other time. But it's certainly going to be a rocky year.
Right. I think your provocative headline says we're back to the Wild West.
Yes. It's going to be there's a lot of disruption in the employee wellness marketplace right now.
Well, and so for consumers who, you know, work for employers who have these programs in place, they are still in place for the current year, right? We're talking
That's right.
about 2019 at this stage.
2019, the rules that are in place right now will no longer be in place. Something else maybe, or maybe nothing, which, again, the Wild West. So it'll be an interesting year. 2018 is turning out to be a very interesting year in that way.
Seems like it is always an interesting year to be a health and wellness lawyer.
That's right. Never a dull moment.
Well, Barbara Zabawa, thank you so much for helping us understand these things.
You are welcome. Thank you.
Barbara Zabawa is a clinical assistant professor in the College of Health Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. She owns the Center for Health and Wellness Law.
She is also a regular health policy contributor to Lake Effect. Our interview first aired last month.
Coming up after a break,
we'll meet a local ambassador to Korean culture who introduces us to some of it just in time for the Winter Olympics.
That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Before the Olympics were announced in Pyeongchang, most people associated the word Korea with North and South, or the DMZ, or nuclear weaponry. However, Se-hee Chang asks that you go beyond the headlines and take a closer look at Korean culture.
As the founder of the company Korea Connect, Chang educates people both young and old across Milwaukee, the state, and the country about Korean culture and society. Through teaching others traditional drumming and cooking, Chang is an unofficial Korean ambassador here.
Chang grew up in South Korea and has lived all over the world. Her experience has taught her the importance of cross-cultural education. So instead of thinking about division and conflict when we think about Korea, she wants people to think about unity, yearning for peace, and stronger together. Chang joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio and began by explaining what led her to create Korea Connect.
I actually started out as an international education major, and I worked at different universities, and I was advising international students. I loved working with people from all over the world, and it just made my job so much more fun and exciting. I grew up all over the world, too, because of my father's job. We traveled and lived in Vietnam and East Africa. So my favorite place in the whole wide world is Nairobi, Kenya, and that's where I spent most of my childhood. And having, of course, lived in Korea, born in Seoul, and then, of course, now living in the U.S. for a long time, I just felt like wherever I went, many people knew that I was from Korea, possibly, but they would start out with the question, are you Chinese or are you from China? And I thought, you know what? I need to educate people about who I am through my country and my culture. And I think in general, in U.S. society, people don't always know a lot about Asian countries or Asian culture, or people tend to lump all Asians together. And then the conversation would start, you know, oh, yeah, I learned about the Korean War.
And then, or the Forgotten War.
Yeah. Or they would sort of stop and be like, so is Korea, like, where is Korea? So I would have this sort of frustrating conversation. And that's when I decided I have to start an educational business, educational company, to just keep teaching people about Korea. So that's how it started. Yeah.
Well, and that's fantastic because you have lived in so many places, yet you are grounded and centered on your Korean culture. Did you struggle with your identity as a Korean American? Because you live in Korea up until 12 years old, right?
Right. I did struggle a little bit because, you know, when we first moved to America, I remember the school system saying, well, you know, your English is not quite good, so let's put you in an ESL class. I think people tend to just box you in, right? So Americans would ask me, like, do you eat weird food because you're Korean? Or, you know, and your friends would make fun of you. And you would have some, you know, racial slurs, too, that you would experience. But I think for me, it was just about being grounded with my family and just being comfortable with who you are. But I think it's hard when you're little, and especially when you're at middle school or high school, and you want to fit in and you want to be like the American kids, right? Asian Americans are always considered the other or sometimes the foreigner. I think things are changing for sure, but I think I did have a struggle with my Korean American identity. When I would go back to Korea to visit my relatives, they would say, well, you're so Americanized. Why do you do it that way? And your thinking is so interesting. Is that how Americans think all the time, you know? And so I had also this internal conflict, and I said, wait a minute. I'm still Korean. I'm not American. But now I am so just, you know, so lucky to have these experiences and to be able to say I am a Korean American woman living in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, United States. And what I love now is teaching my kids how to be sort of, you know, proud of who you are or just to embrace your cultures. So my children are half Korean and they're also quarter German, quarter British. My husband is from Northern Germany. So, you know, we sort of get to travel with the kids to Germany, to Europe. We go to Korea. We were just in Korea this summer with the kids. And we tried to tell them, you know, this is who you are. And you are very lucky to be able to navigate all these cultures. So it's a challenge when you're young and you're not quite sure of yourself. But now I feel like sort of my struggles when I was younger have really shaped me in a positive way. And I'm a pretty strong woman. So, you know, I don't know. I think I can sort of embrace it all.
Definitely. And it is that interesting perspective as an adult compared to when you're a kid and trying to balance, well, what do I want to be most a part of? But it's also important for adults to, if anything, be more open about learning about other cultures and not boxing people in. So what is, you know, the importance of cross-cultural education, especially for adults in the United States?
To me, America is so beautiful and wonderful because of its racial and ethnic diversity. That's the most, I think, unique aspect of this society. And so that's why Americans have to learn how to deal with each other. They have to be able to work with colleagues who look different from them. They need to be able to teach students who come from a totally different cultural background. You know, you need to be able to understand ESL students or just have some empathy and a little bit of compassion. I think that'll just make our lives so much easier. And not always, first thing, judge about who you are because, you know, you have dark skin or you look Asian or Chinese. I really feel like it's so important to highlight and really just take advantage of that diversity because I think no other country has this sort of beautiful mosaic of diverse people and backgrounds. And so I think that's why it's so important for Americans to learn about the other. And especially now, politically, it's been sometimes difficult. And I think we just need to realize that we all want the same thing. We're all human beings, you know. And that's, I think, what makes America so unique and interesting.
One really interesting thing you were telling me before we came on air was that you're recently training military members about Korean culture through an immersive class. And you mainly teach people about Korea through traditional drumming and cooking. So tell me about why you focused on music and cuisine.
Yeah. I chose cooking and music because these are the two most comfortable and fun topics. And they unite people no matter what, right? So so that's why I was teaching how to make traditional Korean rice cakes in Bemidji, Minnesota with these, you know, military soldiers. And it was fascinating because they loved it. And they also had some experience with Korea already. And music. I have a lot of friends who are drummers and percussionists. And I feel like for me, anybody and everybody can play a drum. You can bang on a drum and you can make music. So I chose specifically the Korean drumming because I was trained in traditional Korean drumming. I just won a grant through the Wisconsin Arts Board for the Korean Folk Arts Apprenticeship Program. And my role now is to teach other students, other folks, about Korean drumming, and we pass it on in Wisconsin. It's such an honor, and I'm humbled to do that. And I feel like, again, the music, the drumming, it starts breaking down barriers, right? And the drum that I brought is a beautiful wooden drum called the changgu, and it represents the sound of rain. And it's a versatile, beautiful drum, handmade by a master Korean, you know, drum maker. And I hope I can share the rhythms with you soon.
Hopefully, yes. I was also curious to find out that you went back to Korea to learn about this drumming specifically.
Yes.
So we were talking a bit earlier about how you view things differently as an adult. So to be an adult going back to Korea to learn a new art right away, how did that make you feel and did it reaffirm your connection?
Yeah, it was definitely, I think, you know, a little harder, but I was much younger at that time. I was in college, you know, and I'm almost, 50 years old. So I feel like, you know, somehow, you know, just being back in Korea re-energized me. And I felt like, again, going back to your question about sort of being Korean-American and the identity issue, I felt like something was missing. You know, I'm Korean-American, but, you know, I don't know much about Korean history and my tradition and my people's arts, right, or my people's music. So I went back, and it was an amazing experience. I was able to connect with other students, other college students in Korea. And again, just re-immersing back into your country was fantastic. I had been to Korea like almost every year because my parents were living there at that time. But still, just to connect with the young people who were using drumming as sort of a tool for peacemaking or community building, to me, that was just amazing.
With you immersing yourself back into Korean culture and sharing it nationally here in Wisconsin across the U.S., what have you learned about others through teaching them about Korean culture? You know, is there a surprising lesson that you consistently learn with each new group of people you interact with?
I guess it is maybe surprising, but also not so surprising. I learned that we have a lot in common. I was teaching a kimchi making class. Kimchi is a Korean side dish. It's like a pickled and fermented cabbage dish. It's pretty spicy. And I was working with ninth grade boys at Bayview High School. And they were like looking at me like, who is this strange lady and what are we making today? And we started making kimchi together. And at first they were sort of like, you know, making faces like, oh, it sort of smells funny. And then we had a tasting session afterwards. And then a young man came up to me and he said, you know, Miss Chang, this tastes a lot like my grandmother's homemade pickles. So for me, that was sort of a surprise. You know, I didn't realize he was going to compare kimchi to his grandmother's homemade pickles. But it was also wonderful because he connected with me and I connected with him. And I learned something new about his culture, right? So I was like, wow, this is amazing. Same with the drumming. You know, we start drumming traditional. So Korean traditional rhythms are a little bit different. You can't quite compare it to Western, you know, beats. And it's still very different from African drumming rhythms. So, you know, we talked about how these rhythms are so different, but somehow different cultures play drums because of celebrations, holidays, festivals, right? You know, celebrate the successful fall harvest or celebrate a wedding, right? And we started talking about that, like in certain Latin American countries, you know, you do drumming to celebrate, just like Korean drumming. Yeah.
A large part of the recent Olympic opening ceremonies in South Korea was the pinnacle of this massive group of Korean drummers.
Yes.
And you mentioned for people to think of peace and unity. So what does it mean for you to have the unified North and South Korea team?
It means so much to me. And I was thinking of my parents. I hope I don't get too emotional. My mother came. She was a North Korean refugee. She was only 6 years old. But when the war broke out in 1950, so many Koreans from the North fled to the South. My mother's story is just one story, and her family had to leave all, you know, their belongings and some of their relatives behind. And many were killed. They had to cross the river at night. You couldn't, you know, be seen by the North Korean soldiers. So all these sort of scary images of fleeing the war and being a refugee. But at the same time, I feel like my mother, having met my father, who is from South Korea, just, I guess to me, that sort of signifies and symbolizes unity and how, although we are still divided, the Korean Peninsula, you know, still is divided, and you have the DMZ, the Demilitarized Zone, the Korean people are not divided. My mother's family, they have, you know, relatives still in North Korea. They cannot visit. They cannot talk to each other. And I remember my grandfather saying, I hope one day I will be buried in North Korea, back in my village. And we were like, that's not going to happen, right? But I have hope, and I wish for that day when we are reunited. Because I think through a people's goodwill, I think it'll happen. So when I saw all those athletes walking in, oh my gosh, I was tearing up. And, you know, I'm sort of tearing up right now, but it was beautiful. And that's what, to me, the Korean Peninsula and my country represents. And I hope someday that there will really be peace. And I hope other countries will support that, will help to support that. Yeah, especially the, you know, key players around the globe.
Well, we just heard word that Kim Jong-un's sister invited South Korea to come to North Korea. So that's a major accomplishment.
I know. Yes, yes. So, yeah, there is definitely hope, right, Audrey?
Yes. So with the Olympics in Pyeongchang highlighting Korea on the global stage, what do you want people to keep in mind after the Olympics are done? Mm-hmm. You know, after this great symbolism, this great sportsmanship.
Yeah.
Of, you know, it's only
that's
2 weeks.
Question.
You know, what should people still keep in mind about Korea after the Olympics are done?
I want people to still keep reading and learning about Korea. Read about South Korea. Read about North Korea. Don't always just automatically believe what the, you know, sort of the main media says about our country and our cultures. I think it would be great if you're a parent, talk to your kids about Asia, specifically, of course, for me, Korea. Maybe reach out to a Korean-American or a Korean friend or a colleague and just learn more about their stories. And I think through reaching out and having that personal connection, you know, make it more personal. Don't just think about Korea's over there and we're over here. Our world is not that huge. So I want people to enjoy the Olympics, of course, enjoy all the cool sports. But think about how does South Korean trade affect U.S. trade if you're a businessman, right? And think more carefully about cultural nuances. And, you know, again, just go beyond that, I guess. It's not just only for Korea. It applies to other countries around the world. For me, it's not just, you know, reading about the headlines, just going a little bit beyond that. Yeah.
Well, Sehi Elan, and thank you so much for coming in today and sharing some of this information with us.
Yay. Thank you.
Sehi Chang is the founder of Korea Connect, a service that educates people about Korean culture, society, music, and food, as well as offering interpreting and translation services. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can find out more about Korea Connect and listen to a Korean folk song Chang performed in our studio at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, a multimedia celebration of Black History Month is currently on view at 25th and National and online. We'll meet the woman responsible for both when Lake Effect continues. That's right after this on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. February is Black History Month, a time to celebrate African-American voices and visions. To do that, local blogger Maria Cree Miles has curated a show called Black Like We Never Left. The project asked Milwaukee women artists of color to reinterpret and celebrate pieces by nationally known women artists of color who've come before them.
These reinterpretations are as wide-ranging as a burlesque piece set to Nina Simone's Feelin' Good to an open letter to author Zadie Smith. Or, in the case of painter Jessica Jimenez, a reinterpretation of painter Harmonia Rosales.
Miles says that this project is a labor of love and explains to Lake Effect's Mayan Silver why she took it on.
When I was trying to figure out what the blog was going to do for Black History Month, I started trying to figure out where my original relationship with Black History Month came from. And I realized, like, I instantly thought about this poem that I'm sure if you called any of the local elementary schools right now, one of them would be putting the poem on as a show, and it's called The World Without Black People. And so it follows the story of this little boy named Theo. And in the morning, he's like, Mom, what would the world be like without black people? And his mom's like, I don't know. Let's figure it out, Theo. Go get dressed. So Theo goes and he puts his clothes on. He comes out and his mom is like, Theo, where are your shoes? And then the narrator comes in and is like, well, Theo didn't have any shoes because the shoe repair machine was invented by a black man, Jan E. Meltzinger. And it just goes on. There's no ironing board because it was created by a black woman, Sarah Boone. The lights don't work because an integral part of the light bulb was invented by a black man named Lewis Latimer. And so the final stanza of the poem is like, so if you ever wonder where you would be without a black person, it's in the dark. And so, like, that's the end. And I never liked that play, like, my whole life. I was just like, this is so corny. But this was the first time that I ever interrogated why I didn't like it. First of all, it's connected to the fact that it is all about black people creating these utility items, like things that they create to make their lives easier to live. And if you want a demonstration of black people's resilience, I mean, that is abundant. So we don't really need another piece exemplifying that. And then the other part of it is, like, it's cool that a black woman invented the ironing board, but I want to talk about black women who invented masterpieces, because we're also able to do that. And when we're talking about humans at their best or at their highest existence, it's about them creating art that we really don't need, but then we do need. And so it's cool that we created all these things that we use every day, but we can also create fine elite art, and we can create fine elite literature and dances. And I think that's what I really wanted to focus on, because even as far as representation goes, if you meet a little kid, they might care that the refrigerator was invented by someone like them. But if you take them into an art gallery and they see this huge oil canvas of someone and they look in the eyes and the eyes looking back at them is in a body like theirs, they'll feel that much more than they'll feel the fact that the refrigerator was created by a black man. So I think that's what I was really going for.
Well, so that brings me into you were talking about kids, and this is a kid's book and a kid's play you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
What was your first experience with seeing a piece of art made by a woman of color or depicting a woman of color? Do you remember that?
Yeah, well, I remember when we went to the art museum as a child. I grew up in Milwaukee and Menominee Falls. And when we went down, and that huge sculpture of that black woman, it was in a black stone. I have no ideas the details of that piece, but I remember we were walking around and I'm seeing these giant oil canvases of these white royal families from a kabillion years ago. And I was like, it's cool. Like, I can appreciate anything that's done well. But it was on our way out that we saw it. When I saw that huge sculpture, I was like, oh, this is dope. Like, I feel that. I feel like that's me more than any of the other things that I've seen.
Was that a limited experience? You know, it didn't happen to you very often that you saw women of color depicted in art, or, you know, you saw reflections of yourself in these works of art. Mm-hmm. Was that hard to find?
Yeah, I mean, it was. And the thing about it being hard is you don't even know that it's happening. Like, you're just going through life appreciating the things that are given to you. I love Edgar Degas. I love his work. And it's so interesting because even when I'm looking at these pieces that these women are honoring, I'm like, oh, yeah, look, a black woman. Like, you're so used to not seeing them that when you see them, you, like, do a double take, even as one. Like, I'm a black woman, and I'm still surprised when I see a black woman in art, which is crazy.
So how did you get turned on to all the artists that are being showcased in this project? How did, because it's like a crash course in some amazing art.
I know. I totally know. Well, honestly, I made a list for the artists who are in the show to pick from, but they all already had their own artists, which I can completely understand. I feel like if you are perfecting a craft as meticulous as visual art, you've already latched on to some women who first you see yourself in and you connect to the work that they're creating. So every one of them picked a woman that I had never heard of. And so I'm just like going down the rabbit hole on their websites, on their Instagrams, like, what is going on? Like the Rosalie piece of her hung on a cross, like a black woman on a cross. I was like, where am I? This is literally the most amazing thing. So they put me on. The women who created the pieces put me on.
So can you name some of the women? There's Micheline Thomas, mm-hmm. right? And
There's
Harmonia Rosales.
Harmonia Rosales, Kara Walker, Lena Iris Victor, and the one that Gabby picked. I can see her name, but I cannot say it. It starts with a W-W-A-K.
Oh, yeah. Mutu?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And those were all the artists that were celebrated, and all of their pieces and all of their websites. Like, don't get on social media. Go get on an artist's website because you'll be there for days.
You're showcasing this at an actual art space, right?
Yeah. It's on the south side. It's on 24th and National Canned Beats Art Space. They're going to be up the whole month of February. Yeah, we had an opening on February 1st because I wanted to kind of bring in Black History Month honoring these pieces, but they'll be up the whole month. So if anybody wants to stop by and check them out, they're amazing.
What did it feel like entering into that space where there were a bunch of pieces with black women and that had created the pieces and that were making homage to other women like that?
Well, I think I had layers of experiences that night because I'm generally a performance artist. Like, I sing a lot. And so to know how much work was put in by me to get these pieces here, and then I'm not even the ones who created them. Like, knowing that these women were working on these pieces for hours and hours, and then for them to just be up on the wall, compared to, like, when you have a show after hours and hours of rehearsal, there's lights and there's, like, a screaming crowd and all of that. It just... I wanted more. And I was like, is this the life of a visual artist? Like, you pour all of this into something and then people just quietly come and look at it. I don't know. It just, I felt like there just needed, something else needed to happen because they're so beautiful. The pieces are so beautiful.
Yeah, they are so beautiful. And one of them, well, let's talk about the woman who recreated Micheline Thomas.
Mm-hmm, Kirsten.
Kirsten
mm-hmm.
Ghaznavi.
Mm-hmm.
And so Micheline Thomas, I read about her, and she was mostly, she has these gorgeous, vibrant photos and paintings, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they're consistently depicting women from the 60s through the 80s, where there was a big time of overhaul, the civil rights movement,
yeah.
You know, black feminism and the new wave of
womanism.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so how does that sort of art speak to you at a time period now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how is it still fresh and still impacting you? Can you describe that?
Yeah. Well, I can't say if I had a favorite or not, but I can say that I for sure really, really loved the piece that Kirsten did, and I really, really, really loved learning about Micheline Thomas. First off, the visual appearance of Micheline, like how she's a huge woman and how much space she just unapologetically takes up, and I watched some YouTube videos of her, like, giving tours of her studio space, and I was attracted to that she was so unconventional in her appearance and still unapologetically took up so much space and unapologetically perfected her craft. So I appreciated that on so many levels. Until we have as much representation of black and brown women touring in galleries that are up for months, and it's not just a novelty once every 12 tours piece, and until there's an even amount of brownness and womanness, then it's still relevant. Like, until everyone understands that everyone in all of their intersections deserves to be seen as much as the ones who are conventionally seen, then we still have to keep, we have to keep creating it and fighting for it to be in extremely public spaces.
And what do you think about, I mean, because Micheline's subjects are in these settings, they're in vibrant colors,
yeah.
And they're just beautifully decorated and with clothing and jewelry and then the patterns behind them, and it's just gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
And then this black skin, which is just,
yeah.
You know, kind of really nice, it just focus in,
yeah.
In the piece.
Because you're not used to seeing it.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so how does this art sort of portray beauty mm-hmm. in a different way?
Well, like, speaking to the vibrance of the pieces Micheline creates, right after the Super Bowl happened, and I saw everybody's Facebook comments complaining about how mediocre Justin's performance was, I was torn because I loved it, but I might be easily entertained. And it's also, like, I grew up with those songs. So I was like, so do I just love this because I know them? So then I watched Justin's performance back-to-back to Bruno's performance, back-to-back to Beyoncé's performance. And Beyoncé's was extra. Like, she had that huge thing set on fire of her posing, and then she stands there. And I was like, black women are. We are. And a lot of times I think we feel like we have to be because you ignore us in our regularness. So when we show up to the 80th power. So I felt like when I was looking at Micheline's pictures, she was like, I'm not just going to take pictures of black women, like, posing like royalty, like the Romanoffs. I'm going to take pictures of black women in our true surroundings. Because, I mean, and also a lot of times throughout our history, all we had control over was our appearance. So we just took, like, we took extreme pride in it because that's all we had. That's what I thought about when I saw hers and the hats and, like, the cheetah print and the fur. I was just like, it speaks to us wanting to be seen. Like, that you, I need you to see us. You're not paying attention. I need you to see me. Do you see me now? Okay.
And then another level of visibility, Harmonia Rosales, she took the creation of painting and then a painting with a crucifix in the middle, and she portrayed Black women as the subjects in those paintings. Mm-hmm. And I guess she got some, I didn't hear about this at the time, but she got some fallout a little bit on Twitter. There was a lot of positive acclaim and people that were definitely loving what she was doing, but then there were some people that weren't. And then I read that, you know, the Simpsons have reinterpreted that creation of you know, all these non...
That nobody had anything to say about.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. So she's doing these groundbreaking paintings, and she said that art is my weapon in the ongoing battle against indifference and inaction. Mm-hmm. It forms the basis of resistance. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that way too?
So much I do. Like, even in the things that I read, Ursula Le Guin just passed a few days ago, maybe like a week now, and she said that the pieces that she was creating was the basis of the revolution. And I connected to that so deeply that when we're starting to create huge systematic change, I think it has to start visibly, like in the arts. It has to start creatively. And so I felt Harmonia on that. And the fact that there was even backlash about it speaks to how conditioned we are to see holy things in a certain light. So that is crazy that that happened. But I mean, it's happening. And I guess when it stops happening, we'll be a little bit closer.
Can you tell me a little bit about the dance component and the writing component of this project?
Oh, sure. So for dance, I asked four local dancers, four women of color, if they could celebrate and reinterpret iconic pieces of music by famous Black women. So I've got Never Loved a Man by Aretha Franklin, Feeling Good by Nina Simone, Hound Dog by Big Mama Thornton, and Where to Cash At by Remy Ma. Well, it's by Lil Wayne, but Remy Ma's verse is the only one that matters in that song. So they all danced to the pieces. And even while we were going through that process, when you look up Feeling Good on iTunes, the first one that pops up is Michael Bublé. When you look up Hound Dog on iTunes, the first one that pops up is Elvis Presley. So even when you're the originator of something, if you're a Black woman, you still are secondary. Like, the fact that Nina Simone is going into the Hall of Fame this year is just blasphemous. Like, seriously? And so it's been such an experience to create this whole process, and to connect with the other Black women has been amazing. But it's just also shown me how much more work we have to do. And really, all I'm trying to do while I am in this process is aid in that work. Like, whatever we have to do to make it so when little brown girls are sitting in class, they feel validated and seen, then I feel like I'm doing something worth doing, really.
Visibility is such a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's an important project that you're doing.
Thank you.
And so thank you for coming on Lake Effect, Cree Miles.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Lake Effect's Mayon Silver spoke with Cree Miles about Black Like We Never Left. The project is up through the end of February at Canned Beats Art Gallery on 25th and National, and it's also online as well. There's more information about it at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break, and then Bubbler Talk tells the story behind some iconic Milwaukee area billboards. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
It's Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM's Audrey Nowakowski. And for this week's Bubbler Talk... But more specifically, a billboard. Listener Michael Crowett submitted this question.
There's a billboard for Koss Company, the headphones, that is on I-43 just south of Hampton. And I've always been intrigued by it. And I was wondering, is it done by an ad agency? Is it done by an in-house person?
Picasso, chicken a la Koss, or rebel with a Koss. If you're familiar with the iconic billboard, you may even have a favorite design or catchphrase. To find out who or what's behind them, I visited Michael Koss, chairman and CEO of the Koss Corporation. He told me it all started with a yellow smiley face back in 1972.
The headline was, "Ever wonder why he's smiling?" and people didn't know who owned the billboard. And then after about 2 weeks, the Koss stereophones were put on the smiley face. And that paid off the headline, and then in the corner, the logo appeared with Koss stereophones beside it. That was how it started.
Over 100 designs have captured the attention of drivers on I-43. Crowitt says he's noticed two things about them throughout the years.
Well, I think, first of all, that they've always been very well designed, and second of all, they've been uniformly witty.
So how does a finished design like Koss Fit or Game of Phones get up on the billboard? Well, an ad agency creates a concept built around either an image with headphones or a common phrase or play on words. Once those elements are decided, they pencil up sketches to present to the company, and a handful are selected for further development. However, Koss says the billboard was never about selling headphones.
Well, you'll never see a board up there that says buy something or some sort of call to action in that way, because that's not what that board is for. It's really set up there to help demark the property, to identify us, to establish the brand. And we think it's a fun product, and it's something that's grown for people. They've fallen in love with the board.
The billboards used to be hand-painted, but now the images are printed on vinyl and installed around the country. Here in Milwaukee, we get to see a new billboard about every 4 months. Currently, the Koss billboard features Julius Caesar and his famous Friends, Romans, Countrymen speech by artist and illustrator Matt Zumbo. He's responsible for over 60 Koss billboards since 1986. And while it is his illustrations you see, Zumbo points out it is a huge team effort.
I'm not, in this case, concepting. I'm problem solving. We go down a certain path, and then it's my job to hopefully bring it to life and make it be all that it can be.
Zumbo has used everything from the traditional pencil and paper to acrylic paint with an airbrush to tablets and computer programs today. Each billboard design can take up to 65 hours to complete, but he says the blend of traditional and digital tools works best. After all these years, his illustrations are a key part of what makes the Koss billboards so iconic.
It's terrific. Of course, it's one more reason to spend time on it and do a good job, because you don't want to drive by and see something that you screwed up, let's say. But really, honestly, for a commercial artist and illustrator, it's got to be the best opportunity, the best job in this area to work on.
The next 2 years of the billboard's schedule are already booked with designs, so we can all look forward to what's next. And as Michael Crowett says,
you never drive by without looking.
But don't forget, driving with headphones on is illegal in Wisconsin, even if they're Koss.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. What's got you scratching your head about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
And Bubbler Talk finishes Friday's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Mitch and I produce the show along with Joy Powers, Audrey Nowakowski, and Mayon Silver. Claudia Delgadillo is our production intern.
We get additional reporting from Rachel Morello and Susan Bentz, studio engineering from Jason Reavy, and Michelle Mananowski is our managing editor.
Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.